That's why Brady always has to wear a hat, because everyone's like, oh, wow, Brady's got the best hair, nice and long and thick.
He's got long locks.
He's just got hair in the back, though.
Party in the back, right, Brady?
But it's in the front, party in the back. Is that what it is?
That's it. Well, we're remote today, so I'm actually in Vegas, and Brady's in his office in Vegas. But we had a special guest on today. We have an OG, Christopher Neville. Always a guest favorite. People always asking, where's Chris Neville? Yeah. So we thought we would do a kind of a preseason kickoff, and we thought we would invite one of the original guest hosts of the Big Hung Guys podcast on the podcast today. So we're happy to have you, Chris Neville.
I'm back. Hopefully I'm not too rusty.
I think you still got it. It's like riding a bike, bud.
Yeah, that's right. I can blab.
Besides that, my youngest kid, he was telling me the other night, I tried to FaceTime Chris Neville, Brady. I was out teaching my 12-year-old to drive, because I think it's good for kids to learn how to drive, you know, when they're little. And so I was out teaching him how to drive, and he's like, hey, let's call Chris Neville. He's like, I don't think I've ever seen Chris Neville. I just want to see him and talk to him. So I tried to FaceTime Neville, and he didn't answer because he said he was grocery shopping.
And then I was wondering, I'm like, why is he FaceTiming me? It's like at 6 o'clock, and then I'm like, why? I thought maybe you're pulling one of those pranks where you say goodnight to like your friends. Have you seen those on Instagram?
No.
Like, no. Where it's like you just call your buddy and be like, hey, what are you doing? Just wanted to say goodnight. And then the other guy's like, what?
I'm going to start doing that to you, Trey. I want to tuck you in at night.
I haven't heard of that. That sounds interesting. I'm not sure if I'm that guy to FaceTime somebody and tell them goodnight. But yeah, my 12-year-old was one to tell Neville that he needed him to make sure he didn't kill a bigger bull than he got a crack at this year. So he was like, I was like, what about me? You're not worried about me? And he's like, I'm not worried about you killing a bigger bull than me. He's like, but I am worried about Neville killing a bigger bull than me.
I told Charles, I said, I've never been one to kill big bulls. Usually a decent one will do.
Yeah, that's right. I guess before we get going, we should hit promo, because we'll get in trouble if we don't, right, Brady?
We will.
Do you want to hit us with promo?
Yeah, we got our – I mean, every time we talk about this, it's pretty silly that we do it, but we got our Refer a Friend program right now. So it's a way for you to basically get $1,000, like $1,000 in your GoHunt account to use on the GoHunt Gear Shop. All you got to do is refer your friends. So you probably got friends out there who don't have an insider membership yet, and you want to refer them to sign up. Stupid easy. It literally takes you 30 seconds to have them sign up. So basically what you're going to do is, if you're already an insider member and your buddies don't have insider accounts, you're going to hunt together this fall. You're going to start e-scouting. You're going to start going on hunts. Well, get them an insider membership so you all can collab and work towards hunt planning and drawing some tags. So basically you take your email address, share that with your friends, and then when your friends sign up for going insider membership, you go through the whole process, and eventually there'll be a spot where they can enter in a promo code, enter in your buddy who has an insider account, so his email address has the promo code. Both of you will earn money. So the new person signing up for a brand new insider account, he'll get $75 to the Going Gear Shop. Your buddy's account, who has original insider membership, he'll get $75. And then if you refer 4 friends to sign up for insider, you get a total of $1,000 to Going Gear Shop. So you get 75 for each, up to 3 people, and then that fourth one, we're going to give you $1,000 to spend on anything in the Going Gear Shop. Pretty awesome. I mean, everyone could use $1,000 to Going Gear Shop. I know I could.
Yeah, Neville, what would you buy if you had $1,000 right now in the gear shop?
Food.
$1,000 food.
Would you really?
I probably need almost, I bet you, for freeze-dried meals for all my hunts I had this year, I need a lot of food. I think I spent $400 on just like snacks.
I've been seeing you picking up snacks lately.
On Amazon? That's just my snacks, $400.
So you've been buying food then, gearing up.
Oh yeah.
So let's catch up with you. So we've talked a little bit, but you live in Colorado now, right?
That's correct. Fort Collins.
You just bought a house?
Just bought a house last October, somehow. Miracle.
How's that going?
It was a little bit of a fixer upper, and I'm not a builder. Like, you know, I'm not very like handy when it comes to like house construction kind of stuff. And I think my wife thought when we bought it, like, oh, I'm going to come home. He's going to be, you know, fixing things up. And instead, I'm like in the yard shooting my bow, trying to figure out how far I can shoot out my backyard. So, yeah, it's been kind of a process just, you know, doing a bunch of housework, redoing all the doors, painting fixtures, putting on doors, just what, all sorts of stuff.
What year was it built, you know?
I think it was 1980.
Oh, so it's not crazy.
No,
old. Was it like it was
it's not super old, but like previous owners, I mean, they basically just lived in it. So it's like none of it was updated. They didn't really keep up with like their home ownership. So there's just a lot of odds and ends you got to fix up one thing at a time.
I think I saw in one video you were scraping those popcorn styrofoam things off the ceiling, and that took me right back to my childhood, man. Like, that took me straight back, like the smell of it, the feel of it, the whole nine, because we did that, seemed like, I don't know, endlessly for at least a couple summers.
Oh, yeah. It was the worst. And it's one of those things, I'm sure a lot of people have been in the same situation. Nothing is easy. Like, you think, oh, this is going to take me 10 minutes. You run into like 17 other different problems. It ends up taking you like 3 hours. Like putting a door, taking off doors and putting new doors on. You think that's the easiest thing? Oh my God. these hinges, I'm telling you. Biggest pain in my ass.
We had a saying for that back in the day when I was working in Glacier National Park. We always said, if you think it's going to take an hour, it's going to take three.
Oh, yeah.
That's literally what it is. So like, oh. Think it's gonna be easy? No, it's not. Never is.
No.
You you got AC in your new place?
No AC.
Really?
It's supposed to be like no AC, and I think it's supposed to be like 95 today. So, but yeah, we did install. So like this house had no fans. So we had to install ceiling fans in all the rooms. Don't ask me how I did that. I just started drilling holes, hanging them.
Have you had to do all the electrical and everything in that too?
Abby's actually pretty good at electrical.
Really?
Yeah, she's probably a better like builder and electrician, like home improvement, than I am. Like,
a handy woman.
Yeah. I think she's done it more than me. I don't like when she before I met her, I think she was always fixing up things at her mom's house and stuff. So
does that make you feel like less of a man?
No, I'm busy. I'm busy trying to. I'm bringing home the bacon. That's what I do. I just go out. Shoot the animals, fill the freezer. That's my job.
You're talking literally bringing home the bacon.
That's right.
Yeah, that's funny. It looks like a sweet piece of property you've got. How much land do you have? And do you have? It looks like you shoot right from your house.
Yeah, so I have like a third of an acre, but then my neighbor has like 2 acres, and it's just like this, you know, kind of a hillside mountain. And I went and asked him if I could shoot my bow in his yard. So he lets me go down. I can get like 60 yards, but it is like straight down shots. Like they're all
cheap angles.
Oh, yeah. There's no flat shooting.
And then you got to walk all the way back up every time.
Sweating bullets. Just, yeah.
Do you have a lot of
steep shots.
Do you have a target uphill and downhill? So you shoot downhill, then turn around and shoot uphill?
No, I don't like to shoot uphill because it's like shooting at houses. Like, at least downhill, it's away from everything. And if I do miss, it's like just going to go into the dirt. But
I thought you were going to say you don't shoot uphill because it's hard.
It is hard.
It's way, way harder.
I was just telling Abby this the other day when we were hiking. Remember on that over the counter hunt? I was like, you see this slope right here? I was sitting here once, was shooting like straight up at an elk. Toughest shot ever.
That was a tough shot. I remember looking over at you as that bull's coming in. I was actually closer to the bull, and it came walked past me, kind of essentially uphill from me, and was like side hill and above us. And it's coming down, and I remember looking over at you, and you were in that, you know, the I like to call it the Usain Bolt celebration. You know, you ever seen Usain Bolt Brady at the end of a race when he does the, you know, the thing like this, and he, you know, spreads his legs way wide, and he's got his arms like this. That's exactly what Neville was doing. I mean, he was in the exact same stance, full draw, like completely crouched down. You might even have been, were you on one knee?
Yeah, because I ended up getting down on a knee because I was trying to go under some brush and shooting like straight uphill with my 50-pound pack on. My pack looks ginormous in that video.
Yeah, you were on one knee with one leg up, and then just shooting completely straight uphill. Is that thing come walking through? And I remember thinking, like, he's pretty close, but that's a really tough shot. Like, he's either going to absolutely sail this thing or just lace it.
Hammered him. I knew it. That was like one of those where you know instantly when you hit it, like, oh, done for.
Yeah.
Those are the best.
That bull, I remember we sat down there and ate a snack, and I remember looking over your left shoulder and just kind of looking up the hill, and like I could see it laying there dead. Like it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet it didn't go. How far do you think that thing went? 50 yards?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, like I could literally look up past Neville's shoulder, like over his backpack as he's sitting there on the hillside eating a snack, and I could see the bull laying there dead.
Yeah.
So it was pretty exciting. How do you like living in Colorado?
I love it. Yeah, I like it a lot. You know, hunting opportunity, obviously really good. I like the northern Colorado location. Just because, it, you know, it's not as busy. Like Denver area, if I want to get out of the mountains, I can just go straight up in the mountains. You know, don't have to worry about the traffic and any of that kind of crap that you get around the Denver area.
And you can go fishing now too, right?
I can go fishing. I live right by a Horsetooth Reservoir. I got a boat. Try to do some fishing every once in a while.
You have a boat?
I got a boat.
What kind
of tiny boat? It's just,
motor on it?
It's like a 10. It's just like a 14-foot John boat with a 10 horse power motor on the back. I just putz around on the lake with.
You got a trailer for it? You just keep it at your house?
I got a trailer and everything.
No way. Are you out there trolling?
Yeah. I mean, I hardly catch shit. The lake is like, it's like smallmouth, walleye, trout. But it's like a fairly big lake. So it's just, yeah, taking some time to figure out where the spots are, where the fish are. And it goes up and down all the time because it's dammed up. There's like water in and out. It's like right now, I bet you it's like at least 25 feet down from where it was last week.
I've been threatening to buy like a small metal boat with a little motor for probably 5-6 years now, and I've never done it. I want to do it pretty bad. So now I can't believe you got a boat. Before I got a boat, I need a boat.
When would you have time trail to go on a boat?
I don't know. That's a good question.
You got to live close, though. That's the thing. Like, I can see the lake from my house, so it's...
Yeah.
Like, it takes me 5 minutes to drop the boat in and go out on the lake.
Yeah, I would
like,
be
if
like...
If I live further away and I actually had to, like, drive 30 minutes, I don't think I would probably go out that much.
Yeah, I would probably be, like, an hour, hour and a half at least to most places, which no,
save your money. Don't do it.
Yeah. I hear, like... I don't know, like a lot of people within our space, it feels like people are moving out of Colorado, right? They're like, oh, I want to get out of Colorado just based on politics and people and population and everything. What's your take as far as politics goes? And, you know, somebody that lived in another state and then moved to Colorado.
Yeah, I mean, so I moved here 2 years ago. So it was kind of like when things, you know, the politics definitely, I mean, they've been kind of going sideways for a while. And as far as hunting, I mean, the opportunity, Colorado's still going to be one of your better states for opportunity as of right now. I mean, there's definitely some issues with CPW, the wolf situation, you know, a lot of these non-hunters trying to take away hunting in Colorado just due to the demographic being a little more liberal, trying to get things on ballots to vote on. But I think the one thing that we have on our side is we have Dan Gates. I think he's hands down the best when it comes to fighting that kind of stuff. And for him to be in Colorado spearheading that, I think is huge. So I'm optimistic just because of him, and I've seen what he's done. I think from the wolf introduction, being voted in at the time I think was really bad. But now seeing, you know, all the negative feedback that people are getting right now and how like that negatively impacted a lot of things, I think people are starting to realize, like the general public are starting to realize, maybe this isn't the best types of things that we should be voting on and be voting for. Because like you see with the prop, what was it, 114 last year with the mountain lions?
127.
You know, that didn't pass, which I think is hopefully what it's going to be like coming in the future. I think more people are realizing that, you know, leave this to the wildlife biologists, the scientists. Like, this doesn't need to be ballot box biology type of thing. So I have a feeling that moving forward that it could get better. I mean, right now it's, we're definitely in the thick of things when it comes to that, when politics and the hunting here in Colorado, but
yeah,
I'm optimistic. We got Dan on our side.
Yeah.
That's all we,
I was going to say, you could be the new Dan when Dan's finally ready to step aside. You got the beard for it, I think.
I don't know. That guy never stops.
No.
That guy's always going.
Yeah. That guy's an absolute animal when it comes to getting out and fighting for what we all kind of hold near and dear to our hearts, you know?
Yeah. No, I think more people are just because, to me, the general public, I would say, is in favor of hunting. It's just, you know, I think all hunters need to be, you know, educating the general public on what it is and what we do and why we do it and the lifestyle. And it's not just us going out and killing animals. And I don't think that's ever, that's usually hasn't what it's been like in the past, you know, like that. Yeah. We just go out and hunt and not have to worry about it.
I think it's interesting that the 127, to me, by the end of it, actually, it felt like the tide turned. So it wasn't even so much about whether or not you were going to hunt lions. It was almost like the secondary message became almost more primary, which was like, let's leave conservation, let's leave wildlife management decisions to people that, you know, actually go to school for that and study it, and they make a living for it. They have a passion for it. They're obviously in those jobs because it was something they wanted to pursue professionally in their life. And it was almost like that was the more primary issue that seemed to like hold the hearts of just like your random voter, right? Was like, hey, maybe this isn't something I even know enough about to be voting on. Like, why am I voting on whether or not mountain lions should be hunting? You know, maybe it should be left over to wildlife professionals. And, you know, maybe there is this thing called the North American Model of Wildlife, and it's worked for a lot of years and seems to be, you know, generating healthy populations. So maybe that should be, you know, the job of a professional. I thought that was interesting in that, to me, it just felt like we went from, you know, a lot of talk about lions. I didn't think it was about lions, but this like secondary message of like, let's leave the, you know, the actual management decisions to the people that should be making them kind of leaked through. And I guess I'm kind of with you. And then my hope is that that message will continue to be primary.
Yeah. And I know for a fact, people had negative impacts from that wolf vote. Like, people who voted for wolves are now against, like, they wish they would have, you know, been in favor of that wolf vote. Like, I've talked to, I was at a concert in Red Rocks, and like someone saw I had like hunting hat on or something, and they're talking to me like, oh yeah, we voted for wolves, but like now knowing all the information and like really understanding it, they wish they wouldn't have. Yeah. So I think there's like, that's happened. Like, there's that negative, you know, feeling from that vote, which I think turned a lot of people to, you know, maybe taking a deeper look into wildlife conservation and not leaving it up to the general public to vote on.
Yeah. What's your perception of being a resident of Colorado as far as your opportunities to go hunting?
I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, I can go buy an elk tag at Walmart, like, you know, and if you play the draws right, and if you understand all your different choices, you know, your A, B, and C tags, like, there's no reason that you can't have an absolute jam-packed, you know, season for every species, you know, male or female, whatever it may be, weapon type. Yeah, I think for opportunity-wise, I think Colorado's still towards the top for resident and non-resident.
I think it was key when you said you have to understand the draw system.
Right.
Because we see it all the time where it's like, oh, residents, they're complaining that they're not drawing. And like, why are all these non-residents picking up tags all the time? It's like, well, these non-residents are picking up pretty easy to draw tags, and a resident could easily snag that tag up, but they're chasing certain things that are unattainable or just don't know how the draw system works and applying for hunts that they actually have zero chance of drawing because they think there's, you know, going to draw it when it's a preference point state. So yeah, it comes down to understanding it, like you said, like understanding all those different license types too. Like, you pick up a lot of tags in Colorado.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
What's the general consensus? I mean, I know that you, like, you have a bunch of guys that you, well, probably not a bunch, but you go to like local archery leagues, and like you're kind of, you know, hobnobbing and rubbing shoulders with other guys that are within your same space that like to hunt and fish. What's the general consensus as far as residents, in regard to non-residents draw only for archery elk? They pretty pumped about it, or like, yeah,
I think most guys are, most residents are definitely in favor for making the non-resident archery hires, you know, draw tags. And I would say majority of them would say they would like to see that for the rifle hunts as well. But it'll be interesting to see, like, your over-the-counter rifle tags this year, how packed that'll be.
Do you think people that would have bought an archery tag will now, since they can't buy an archery tag, they'll buy a second or third rifle season tag?
There's got to be a decent number, I would think.
Yeah.
I guess we can, instead of being archery, let's just go rifle. Not have to worry about the draw or putting in or which area to go to, type of thing.
Yeah. I don't know what the percentage is, but I think it's probably, I would say it's double digits. I would bet people that would have bought an archery tag are now probably going to buy a second or third rifle season tag.
Yeah. And I mean, for the non-residents, if you wanted to archery hunt in Colorado for elk, like, you can definitely archery hunt. Yeah, like, you can pick up a tag, no doubt. I mean, I was just looking at the first leftover list came out a couple of weeks ago. There was plenty of tags for non-residents and some of those, like, that just turned over to draw units.
Has your perception changed from being a non-resident to a resident in regards to those being available OTC versus now them being draw, or is it you don't really care?
I mean, I guess now that I actually live in a state where I can hunt pretty much every single year, I would say, yeah, like I'm in favor of the resident. Whereas, you know, when I lived in Vegas, I wanted all states to be nicer to non-residents. And I mean, I still have the same thing. Like, Colorado, I'm all about residents, but like, I'm still pissed at Wyoming and Montana for their tag prices. Having it be harder to get a tag, type of thing.
Yeah.
It is a tough situation. I mean, I get what you're coming from and get that. Yeah, before when you were a non-resident everywhere, you wish they were nicer. Now that you're in a state that's favorable to residents, it's kind of nice, like you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
But you've seen both sides of it, though, too. You saw, like, you're, and obviously you apply other places where you're non-resident.
Yeah. How's your, what do you have for this year?
So I have archery deer tag. I got archery elk tag. And then I have that archery late season elk tag in Arizona with you.
Gotcha. So you have two tags. You have a deer tag and an elk tag in Colorado.
Yeah. So my plan is right now, what I have is, should be like 20 days of hunting in September in Colorado.
You can
start off with the deer, then head over to the elk.
I would assume they're not in the same area then. You're not like scouting for both at the same time.
No. They're different spots, but
was there any temptation to try to double up those tags? Like double up same unit?
No, not really.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't know if I've found a good spot that has both that are like really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I had three deer points. So I had, you know, as a resident, some like pretty decent deer units that I can choose from for archery. So, and then for elk, I was just whatever comes to my lap, whether that's leftover or put in for a tag or over the counter. I wasn't really for sure what my plan was for elk, but.
You drew a tag last year, right? You burned your points, right? So you built up some points as a non-resident, and then you moved to Colorado. You gained your residency, and then you burned your points, which your points became worth more, right? You burned points on a unit that I'd been chasing for a bunch of years as a non-resident that eventually I just gave up on because I was just looking at this. And then as soon as you drew it, I was like, I'm out. I'm just going I'll go do something else. But What's your plan going forward? I'm curious as to, like, will you build? I mean, I guess we'll have the change in 2028, which will be interesting. But, like, is your plan, do you think you'll build points and then just hunt OTC? Or do you think you'll try to draw, like, maybe these one-point units, two-point units?
This year I was really trying to, like, focus on the leftover list just to see more, not for, like, picking up a tag because I already have an elk tag, but more just to see, like, what does my opportunity look like if I'm just going to say, you know, I'll just do an OTC tag, build up my points, and then just hound like the leftover list to see if I can just pick up a tag without burning points. Going forward, after seeing you know, what's available, I would probably do just plan on doing over the counter, build up my points, and like really pay attention to the leftover list to see if I can't pick up like a pretty decent
tag.
Yeah. Tag there. Cause I mean, the over the counter units here, like I have some spots, you know, obviously a pretty decent, a lot of elk. So I wouldn't be like super worried about having to do, you know, an over the counter unit, but you know, seeing the leftover list, like every single year, there's always a bunch of tags that come up, even for units that, you know, are 3 or 4 points. And then you don't have to burn points.
Yeah.
Just pick up one of those. So that's probably going to be my plan going forward. And that way I can build some points, but don't want to build too many. Don't want to have 9 like I had last year. That's way too many.
I got a question. Do you wait? I can't remember if you applied for Moose Sheep Goat in Colorado before, when you were a non-resident. Did you do that?
I did it that 1 year when they were really cheap.
Yeah. So do you wish now, knowing that, like, you never know where you're going to live in life, and we always talk about there's some states that are just not worth it to build points because the non-resident's never going to draw, but you never know if you're going to move there. Do you wish you would have been building up? So now you would be a resident odds with a stack ton of points to potentially give yourself some better odds to draw those, or do you think it was still just not worth it? And it's like, odds are so slim anyway. Even as a resident, they're slim, but.
Yeah, I probably.
So you're happy with your choice?
Yeah. I mean, now I think I just got my 3 points this year. So I was in the draw this year, and I guess we'll just keep riding and see what happens.
Didn't your brother draw a tag this year? do you care if I out him on that?
Yeah. So like your moose tag, right? They come out and they always hit your credit card first. So everyone already knows they have a moose tag. And he texts me and he says, I just got hit with my credit card. And I was looking, I'm like, oh, the price, I'm like, that's a moose tag. He's like, no way. I'm like, yeah, dude, that's definitely a moose tag. So then it comes out and it looks, and he drew a cow moose tag. So there's like a couple, there's different options, obviously, for a male or female, and he got the cow tag.
Did he try to draw a cow tag?
No, he was trying to get the bull tag.
So we won't out this other person that may or may not be in this office at Go Hunt, but he also did that. A couple years ago, drew a moose tag and ended up being a cow moose.
Well, now I figure out, hell, it must not be too hard to draw a cow moose tag if you want one.
Is he gonna keep it?
No, he turned it back.
Did he? Gotcha.
Yeah. I saw there's a cow moose tag on the leftover list today.
Might be his.
Nope, different meaning.
So how's your summer scouting going? I guess I'm gonna ask this question. So I assume you're gonna start with deer hunting, right? Archery deer hunting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, what's your stuff?
I've mostly been on. Hi. I'm feeling good about deer. I mean, going into this season with the tags I had, I mean, for scouting, I think obviously scouting for deer is going to pay off more during your hunt compared to elk. I'm usually not too worried about elk scouting. Like, I have been in the area a couple times, so I have like a decent lay of the land and have like spots picked out. But my main effort was scouting for mule deer. Never been in this unit, had no clue. And just knowing that where you find the deer, you know, during the summer, like they're most likely going to be in that same area come hunting season. So yeah, I've been putting a lot of effort into scouting for mule deer. And first time I went out, saw probably like 50 bucks in 2 days, like easily the most amount of deer that I've seen scouting. And this is like your typical.
Did you say 50?
Oh yeah, everywhere I looked.
So the high country is looking good.
Yeah, I will say. So I was there. That was like in July, and then I just went last weekend back out there. Definitely drier.
Mm-hmm.
Like things are definitely drying up. I know. I think just looking at the drought maps. Like most of the high country is definitely getting drier right now. So more interested if that's like affected where the deer are going to be, if they're changing slope sides, stuff that's got more moisture and that kind of thing. But yeah, the spot I went into last weekend, didn't see a damn thing, zero deer. And these are your prototypical high country basins, you know, same looking basins that I saw 50 bucks, you know, a couple weekends prior in a different area. But I think one, it just goes to show, like, not every basin that looks good, you know, might not have deer for whatever reason it may be.
But, so let me ask you. So you found $50 and then you didn't go back to the same area to check on those bucks. You went to, you were looking at new areas. Why?
Yeah. I want to have multiple options. I don't want to just be stuck to that one spot just in case, you know, something happens, bunch of hunters. Like, I'm pretty confident, you know, I went there, I saw 50 deer. Like, I know there's deer in that area. Like, come hunting season, like, I know that. So there's no point for me to going back in there and just confirming what I already know.
But let me ask you, was there not a buck in that first area that you would be stoked to shoot?
Oh yeah, big buck.
So
covered big bucks.
I'm with Neville right now. Like,
I'm on the opposite side.
I've been, all the times I go in the high country and look, the deer are there every single day. It's like, yeah, they might move. You might not see a big buck one day, but the next morning you might see him again. If he already knows where his spot is. I've gotten burned so many times in the high country, like you're saying, people, weather, it gets really dry and deer move. Like, you need to have backup plans. You can't go in all eggs in one basket. You cannot.
No.
You don't know what's going to happen to those deer right before you're going to hunt.
But don't you think there's value in, like, absolutely knowing all the ins and outs of that target that you want to kill? And then to me, I'm like, I'm going to go figure that thing out, and I'm going to throw all my eggs in that basket, and I'm going to kill him. I'm going to try to kill him, like, the first 2-3 days, right? And then if not, like, if he is gone, then I'll try to figure out some backup.
But look at what the date is right now. We're, you know, middle of August. He still has a lot of time left to go back if he wanted to. Yeah. Look at those $50 one more time and then hold him in.
That's true.
So my plan is... So, like,
early, I think you got to keep running around looking at more deer or country.
Yeah.
Big.
I'm with Brady as well. I know the deer is probably going to be there. And my plan is, so the season starts September 2nd. I'm going to go out, like, August 29th. So, I'll give me, like, 3 days before the season starts to hone in my search. But, like, right now I'm trying to keep it pretty broad. I want to have multiple options, areas, know multiple different places to go, because my thought is, like I was saying, is, like, for the most part, I think that deer is going to be in the same area. It might be a basin over here, basin over there. If I go back, I'm just going to be looking at the same deer, knowing he's in the same area.
Yeah, but you'll know everything you'll know everything about him.
I knew everything about the big giant I was chasing last year. I went up there. I drove all the way to whatever state I was hunting and scouted it twice in the summer, went back to the same spot. Every day was in the same area. Yeah, I learned a lot. I knew where he bedded. I knew how high in the mountain he fed. I knew how far, you know, one direction, how far the other direction he went, where all these other little bucks were. Both times I went up there, he was there. Sure, I checked out little areas as well to a little bit of a backup, but I still focused there. And then come to hunt, and sure, I had muzzleloader tags. Things can be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. All the other bucks are there except the big giant buck, and there's a couple other deer that are missing, and now I don't have a really solid backup plan. Sure, I saw some other deer, but I put all my eggs in one basket trying to hunt a giant and trying to learn about it, and then I was scrambling the whole entire time trying to figure out where's another place I can class into this, where's another basin nearby that maybe he'll go into. I don't know where he's going to go into.
Yeah. And
struggled the rest of the time to try to find him and another shooter buck.
Yep.
And I did that.
One thing I hadn't really considered, which is – it's bizarre to me, is that, like, in Utah, where I'm from, like, that hunt opens, like, mid-August, right? Nevada, it's been open since, what, last Friday? So it opens the 10th. But you don't open until the 2nd of September.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's way late.
Are you not stoked about the 2nd of September opener?
Don't like it at all.
Yeah, no, why? Because they just do it for the elk hunters. Oh, look at that. Colorado kid.
I don't like it at all. One, it just puts more people in the field. So, I mean, 3/4 of the guys I'll see are going to be elk hunters.
Yeah.
Like, they're just going to be running around doing shit. Like, I'll see a bunch of elk hunters. You know, that only gives you, you know, I think you got about 10 days before they start stripping their velvet, and who knows where they can go from there.
Yep.
And, it, I mean, it's just, it's going to be drier too, for sure. Like, I can.
For sure.
It's going to be drier. Like, it just gives them more opportunity to go places where you don't know where they're going.
Yeah.
There's, that's, like, hard to plan for.
And that August 15th, where, you know, things are still pretty lush, you know, they're going to be up high hanging out for another month.
Yeah.
So are you going to try to go up there then couple days before September 2nd, try to tie your buck down, try to look at him again, or are you going to go another scouting trip here and there?
Yeah, so after my last scouting trip where I didn't see any deer, I've kind of decided, like, obviously that area's got, like, good deer numbers. So maybe not go to, like, the exact same basins that I was at before, but focusing on that general area. Like, if I know there's a bunch of deer, like, there's probably deer close by in other basins if this is where, you know, the deer numbers are at. So hopefully go up there one more time, maybe check out some new basins to see what's in there. And then, yeah, like, 3 days before the hunt, I'm going to go back to where I saw that big buck and really try to figure out if he's still in that same spot. But to me, I'm always like this too. I can always find a bigger one somewhere else. That's sure. That's always in the back of my head, literally. That's like always in the back of my head. It's like, oh, I see a basin, I'm just thinking, I'm like, there could be a 200 incher in that one. I have to go check it out.
That's the addiction, that one more ridge mentality.
That's right.
It's an interesting thought. I get married to a buck. Like, I'll find a buck and I'll be like, that buck's big enough. Like, there might be bigger, but that one's big enough for me where I'm at right now. Like, I'm just going to move in with him. I'm just going to live with him. And I want to know everything about him, and I'm just going to hunt him, you know? But that is always a little back of your head. Like, what else might be over that next ridge?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think too, just having options.
Well, like, you learn a lot, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just knowing, you know, like, I know now not to go to that one basin that was 6 miles in, you know, an hour drive the other direction, where if I was doing that on the hunt, I'm wasting half a day, day and a half probably, easily.
Yeah. Yeah, at least.
What did you see?
I saw bighorn sheep, a few elk, and a goddamn wolf.
So I was a little fun. Trail was telling me that when I was driving back from hunting the last couple of days. You saw a wolf.
30 yards. Walked right to me.
What were you doing? I want to hear the whole story.
So I just got done glassing. Didn't see anything. Was heading, this is like on Sunday morning. So it was like mid-morning. I was hiking back to the truck to go back home. And I was going down. I was in like a creek bottom, just like a bunch of willows and stuff. And I'm walking on a hiking trail. Like, this is where people definitely have walked. Like, it's a decently busy area as far as hikers. And I could see something kind of bouncing around in the willows. And at first I thought it was a coyote. I'm like, oh, this thing's walking right towards me. So I got my phone out and I just started recording it. Then I saw its head. And I'm like, oh, that's way bigger than a coyote head. And then the instant, I'm like, that's probably a wolf. And they just kept walking up the creek, came walking right towards me, like 30 yards broadside. And I could see, like, it had a big collar on its neck. And it, like, kind of looked at me and was just kind of not doing much. And then I think it caught my wind or saw me and then just kind of skirted it. Like, didn't really spook that hard, just kind of skirted around and stopped and just kind of looked back at me and then just kind of went up into the trees.
Aren't wolves supposed to be a lot smarter than that?
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, this is a dumb wolf.
How far were you from, I mean, do you generally know, like, how far that wolf might have ranged from where they were released?
I have no clue. Yeah. They say, like, I was reading about it, there's some of them are moving like 60 miles a day.
Yeah.
So I know they definitely cover a ton of country. I mean, I don't know if that was the reason why I wasn't seeing any deer in that area. I mean, now that after I saw the wolf, I did remember when I was walking in to, like, my glassing knob, like, I saw, like, a deer leg. Like, something that had eaten a deer. So I don't know if that was from him or whatever it may be. And then you, like, I don't know how long that wolf stays in that area. You know, is that its home? Or is it just covering country, like, we just bump paths walking through?
It's probably a little bit surreal, right? Because, like, you see it, my mind wouldn't be like, oh, that's a wolf. Like, because I just don't see wolves. I was telling you earlier, like, when you'd seen that, you sent me video, but I was like, I've never seen one, like, in the wild. You know what I mean? So it's not like I would expect to see a wolf. I would be like, is that somebody's husky? Like, what is that?
It was
probably a little bit surreal, I think.
Yeah, because I was looking, I think right now, so they released 25. And I think there's 16 of the released alive. That's not including like pups and whatever. That's like just the original release with like the collars on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those 16.
Dang.
The odds of seeing that are probably pretty slim.
Yeah.
Because you always hear too, like people that hunt them, you know, they're an apex predator, so they don't just show their face in the open in the daylight.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think the odds, given the fact that there's only maybe 16, there's probably a few more kicking around that maybe naturally like just rolled in from Wyoming or something like that. But the odds of seeing one of 16 is pretty slim, I would think.
Yeah. And I kind of had an idea in that area that there were some wolves just from, you know, I stay up to date on the maps of kind of like where they're located at and stuff. And I knew they're probably in that area somewhere. But like you said, you think like, what are the odds of me seeing one of these wolves running around?
Yeah. Somebody hit me up and they were like, oh yeah, I saw Neville, saw a wolf. And he's like, man, that would freak me out. Did it freak you out at all? Like, were you scared at all?
No, not really.
Yeah, me either. I wouldn't think I would feel fearful, but it is bizarre.
No. Yeah. I mean, the one thing I would say is, I mean, if it did start coming like closer, I mean, I think every hunter has like that natural instinct of, you know, like you don't want, you know, any animal to get 3 feet away from you and it's like fight or flight and they do something stupid.
Yeah.
You know, whether that's a bear or a moose, you know, usually like deer and elk, not too worried about, but like predators, I think there's like that barrier of like range where you don't want them to break, where they start to maybe be like, all right, that's a little too close. But yeah, 30 yards, I wasn't too worried about it, you know, coming at me.
You know why you didn't see any deer? It wasn't the wolf. It's because you were in church on Sunday morning. You're supposed to be in church sitting around right. looking for deer. You heathen.
That's right. No kidding.
That's why you didn't see any deer.
I was trying to think, maybe there's some sort of sign seeing a wolf. Like, what do Indians say if you see a wolf come right up to you? I mean, I've seen the movie like Dancing with the Wolves.
That's right.
They have wolves. There's definitely like, right? Yeah, that's me.
That's right. You're Kevin Costner.
That's right.
Two socks. Did you see Brady's shirt today?
Now, what do you got? Muley's
greater than elk.
So I was gonna ask Neville because the Peaks is doing a little campaign. They've got, I got one that says elk over muleys. So I was curious, you got bull tags this year. Like, which one are you more excited about?
I like elk hunting better. But I do like, I'm not like full anti mule deer hunting.
Yeah.
I like archery mule deer hunting in the high country. Not a huge fan of rifle mule deer hunting. I seem to suck at that. But but as far as if I had to choose like archery mule deer, archery elk, I definitely choose archery elk.
Boo.
Yeah, I was wondering.
I've come up with a good reason why this is.
Okay, let's hear it.
So archery elk hunting uses every single scent when it comes to hunting. It uses your smell, your vision, your hearing. It's more immersive. Like, it uses all of your senses. Like, you're using those all the time. Mule deer, it's not as immersive. You're not using all your, like, you're not smelling mule deer. You're not hearing mule deer. I'm just seeing mule deer. That's it.
That's true.
That's my conclusion of why I think I like elk hunting better. You can smell them. You can hear them. You can see them.
You know what other animal smells really bad?
Pig.
But they taste delicious.
That's right. And elk taste better.
That's true. What are you going to do? So when's the archery elk opener? It's the same day, right?
Same exact day.
Same exact day. Like, what if you, and I would assume based on kind of what I know of you, you probably by the time maybe the 10th of September rolls around, 12th, your 14th, you're going to be getting the itch to go elk hunting. What are you going to do if you still got like 180, 190 inch mule deer buck that you haven't killed, but you're still seeing him day in, day out?
So but my plan is like last would be like where I think it's the 12th. September 12th. I think it's because my plan is to do like the 20th, the last 10 days of archery elk. So it gives me up until then, you know, to hopefully get it done with deer. But I want to go like those first 8 days. And then if I don't get it done those first 8 days, I'll probably go the next weekend for deer.
And then, does it concern you all with the muzzleloader opener on the 13th of September for deer?
Yeah.
So you'd rather try to get your deer done before then rather than deal with more hunters in the field also chasing mule deer with a weapon. Right.
But then, I mean, at the same time, it's like if I do have to go out that weekend, I'd rather go deer in my unit because it's harder to draw. So the muzzleloader traffic won't be as bad. Whereas if I go elk hunting during muzzleloader season, people everywhere. Like in the unit that I have, like easy to draw, like numbers are super high. So that's kind of my thought on the muzzleloader season. Like I'd rather be deer hunting if I still have a deer tag than elk hunting.
How you gonna feel if you're up there like September 7th and you're hunting that buck and you hear some bulls bugling down below you in the timber line?
I'm gonna have to take a look, see what they are.
Are you gonna pull up shop and go hunt out though? Like you start hearing some bulls ripping?
No, I can't. Can't do it.
Good guy.
I'm fully focused on the deer. I did see when I was out scouting 300 elk.
Wow.
For deer. When I was scouting for mule deer. Ton of elk everywhere.
Really? Any good bulls?
No, it's just like huge cows and calves groups. But I mean, by September they won't be hanging out in the high country as much as a mule deer, I wouldn't think.
Yeah. How was your hunt last year for elk? Looking back on it, you've been almost a full year. You look back on it, you feel satisfied with the number of points it took you to draw and the experience that you had?
Oh yeah, I mean, as far as elk numbers and experience, I mean, that's like your typical, what you dream about, just bulls bugling every single day, seeing hundreds of elk every single day. The one thing I do wish I would have changed is I kind of like got away from, you know, the typical style of elk hunting that I do because it was a better unit, like backpacking, you know, just kind of staying with the elk. Like, obviously, it's a limited entry unit, some better road systems. Like, you don't have to hike as far off the road to get in the bulls. So I ended up doing a little bit more of that, which I wish I would have just stuck to, like, what I've always done and just, like, backpacked and gone in and stayed with them all the time instead of kind of, like, truck hunting, essentially. But, I mean, it still worked out. I shot a bull and everything, but, yeah, I definitely wish. Then I think the other thing, too, is I got stuck in like glassing all the time.
What?
Like trying to find like big bulls, you know, just like glassing instead of just working country. And essentially what I did was I got away from the style that I've normally done and I've always done. It kind of like went to a different style of hunting because of a, you know, different caliber tag, which.
What did the experience change between having like hunting OTC stuff to hunting like a limited entry bolt with your bow? Like, is there a noticeable difference in the quality of the hunt?
Oh yeah.
Just in terms of like people or more animals, bigger bulls?
More animals. You're an elk every single day. Hmm. I mean, you're an elk the whole entire hunt. Just constantly. Just elk everywhere. Whereas like, you know, you own like a general tag or an OTC tag. You'll have some days where you don't see a damn thing, won't hear a single thing. I mean, it's definitely more of a grind. First, like this, like you can go into any spot and go anywhere and you're gonna run into elk.
So are you passing a lot of bulls?
Yeah, I mean tiny ones.
Yeah.
My computer's gonna die. I'm like so prepared today, you guys. I'm like, I was late I was late an hour. Now my computer's gonna die. So I'm gonna let you guys carry on for a quick sec while I grab a charge. All right.
Good luck.
Thanks.
I thought he was peeing.
That's what he has to do, honestly.
I know that's what he was running off to do. But yeah, that was like the one thing that I would take away from like those limited entry hunts is stick to what you normally do just because it's a different unit, different caliber. Like you hear of all these different things that you should do to shoot a big bull. Whereas if, you know, maybe if I would have just done what I normally do.
So we like take an outside influence that people are like, oh, you should like do more glassing and try to find a big bull. Like,
right. Yeah. Like my scouting, all I did was glass. Like I just glassed. Like I was trying to find big bulls.
Yeah. You never walk around looking for wild loves. Right. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like normally what I do when I scout. It's like just find country that looks like it's going to be good for running. Because, I mean, everyone knows elk are, like, it doesn't matter where you find them in the summer. Like, they move so much come September in the rut. Like, they're not even going to be close to the same spot. So it's like, what's the point of even looking besides you just know there's a big bull and he might be 7 miles in a different direction come September versus like finding country that looks conducive to, you know, holding bulls for rut activity kind of thing. But I mean, I wasn't concerned though at the same time, just because it's, there's so many elk numbers. Like it's not hard to run into bulls here and there.
Did you have a lot of pressure you dealt with by people being still limited entries, still limited on tags?
No, I would see. I mean, yeah, you'd run into people. I mean, there's definitely areas in the unit where more people. I mean, it's limited entry. I feel like nobody's hiking in. Like everyone's trying to hunt off the road, not too far. And the one thing I would always, everyone I talked to, if they weren't seeing elk, they're like, yeah, I've been hunting this for 7 days, haven't left yet. I'm like, why? Why are you still here? Like, there's no elk here. That's probably like the number one comment that I get when I run into people elk hunting is like, they've been in the same spot for multiple days and aren't having any luck. I'm like, why don't
or
you move?
Too scared to move on and try something different? Or maybe they scouted bulls there. And like you said, they migrated and moved out of there for the rut. So yeah, I'm going to stay here. It's going to eventually happen.
So, I mean, it just goes to show that's like, you gotta keep moving. If there's no elk in that area, go to the new spot. Get out of there. Like, don't just get in love with an area that looks good if there's nothing there.
So that's a great one of the questions I was going to ask you, Neville, is like, what are your top three like elk hunting, archery elk hunting tips? As we kind of approach that September time frame, I think that's a great tip. Just don't stay put. Don't stay stagnant. You got to keep moving. And I think people underestimate the size. Maybe they don't. I don't know. But my gut feeling is that maybe people underestimate an elk's ability to just like move country. Like they can carve out a living most places, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, where I'm from in southern Utah, those bulls can be up high in elevation all summer long, you know, maybe that first half, 3 weeks of August. And then, you know, they'll move, but they'll move. I mean, some of those bulls will summer in the high country and then they'll end up rutting and pushing cows like down in the sagebrush and pinyon and juniper country, right? So like they'll move in a lot of cases just miles and miles and miles. And then daily, like they can be in brand new, you know, two or three drainages over. Like they can just move a lot and they can carve out a living because they eat a lot of different stuff and, you know, they're just a big ass animal. But any other tips that jump to mind?
I would say another one would be if you're on elk, keep pushing. Like, keep on them. Keep going. I mean, there's a number of times where, you know, it's 10 o'clock and they're still bugling and still going. And you're like, oh, I'm going to take a snack or I'm going to, you know, they're too far away. I'm just going to let them be. You know, I found that if you just keep pushing, keep going, like staying on their heels and like being right on them. Like as long as you possibly can, like that's going to give you your best chance for something to like break off, come back and, you know, hopefully give you a shot. But I feel like a lot of people chase them in the morning, you know, they're kind of on them and then they kind of get too far and then, you know, they get tired usually from hiking a bunch of miles and they think it's kind of over. I think having that mindset, like it's never over, just like keep pushing, keep staying on them. You know, keep putting the pressure on that herd and like staying as close as possible. I think that's going to give you your best chance to hopefully, you know, get a shot. And then the other thing I would say, you know, get a good range and have good shot selection when elks come in. Like, I don't think people think about that enough as far as like shot selection, range finding. Like I would rather have it like a for sure range on what I'm shooting, then, you know, like if I have to, even if I spook an elk a little bit, cause I'm like trying to range, like I'm more worried about having a good range on where this ball's coming through. Like that's my first first priority. It's like, I want to know, I want my yardage to be close to exact as possible.
So you would risk spooking a bull to range him?
If I could, I mean, probably not like range on him, but like have, let's say he's like walking through the trees and I'm like trying to range like the hole he's coming through. Like if it was not range or range find, I would range find.
Ideally, you would have arranged a bunch of stuff right prior to.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard. There's a lot to think about. Like, there's a lot to process to like try to make a shot actually happen on a bull as he's walking through the timber, because it's like everything is so heightened. All your senses are just pounding, and like your mind gets a little bit mushy. At least mine does. And it's like hard to know what to do. Like, do I pull out a cow call? Do I pull out my rangefinder? Do I guess the yardage? There's a lot to process.
And I'm saying the number one reason why people have bad elk or bad shots in elk is because miss yardage.
Yeah. It's a good tip.
It's miss. Like, elk are tough animals. Like, you need to hit them in a good spot for them to go down.
Yeah.
Like, so having the best possible range that you can get is, I think, super important. So I'm always range finding as much as possible to try to get the most accurate, and then just having the patience to take the best shot possible.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times you see people like at the first opening they get, they're like wanting to shoot. Whereas if they would just let it keep coming, instead of shooting it at 40 yards in the first opening, you can shoot it at 10 feet, you know, if you wait 5 more minutes, kind of thing. So there's like being patient and being selective, like understanding what you're capable of, what you need to do to make a good shot.
It's easier said than done, right? Because your initial reaction is to like, let's get to full draw. Like, let's get to full draw and first shot opportunity, you know, regardless of what he's doing or facing or whatever, let's try to get an arrow in him, right? It's like your natural inclination is to like try to get it over with quick, to rush it. It's hard. Yeah. It's a hard thing to fight.
The only thing that you can do to learn that is just experience. Yeah. You have to do it. You have to go out. You have to get the reps. You have to be in the woods. You have to be in the mountains. You have to put yourself in positions to where that happens. I mean, I've learned from all my mistakes. Like, I've done every single thing wrong that you can possibly do when it comes to an elk coming into, you know, into a shot. Like, I've done it all wrong. But there's just time. You have to put in the time. You have to put in the reps. And then you start to figure it out. But yeah, like, those three main things would be, first, you got to find the elk. Do whatever it takes to find elk. Move as much as possible. Get on the elk. And then once you get on the elk, push. Stay as close as possible. Keep pushing. Keep putting pressure on them. Like, put yourself in the game. Then once you're in range, like, make sure you have a good range and, like, have good shot selection.
Yeah.
What time of day have you killed most of your elk? I'm curious.
It's got to be, like, mid-morning.
Yeah. Like 10:30
o'clock. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, I mean, what time is it getting? Like 6 a.m.? So you're following elk for 4 hours.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people don't even do that. Like, they get on a herd, they get, you know, a mile out, the elk do, and then the people are like, oh, that's too far. Like, they're already gone. Whereas, just keep pushing.
Yeah.
Just keep going. If you can hear them, keep going at them, because like, they slow up, they get to spots, they start, you know, pushing around cows, you know, some of them might turn around, whatever it may be, but if you're not on them or within distance, like, it's never going to work anyway.
Yeah. What are you shooting for? What's your bow setup like look like this year? How you been shooting?
I've been shooting good.
Yeah.
I'm always shooting pretty decent this time of year. Actually, I go in waves. I usually start to shoot too much, and then I start to shoot like shit, and then I kind of let up, like, need to focus in a little bit here, and then start to shoot good again. I think it's like this time of year you put more pressure on yourself. Like, I want to shoot good. Like, I want to shoot – when I go out and practice, like, I want to hit exactly where I'm aiming. So I put more pressure on myself. So I think sometimes I have days that where I'm not shooting as well. But that's good to feel that. Like, you want to feel that pressure. Like, it should be a heightened experience, like, this time of year.
Yeah, you feel it approaching, right? So maybe your focus is a little bit tighter.
Yeah, you put on a broadhead, you start sweating.
Yeah.
Like shooting.
I brought this up on a podcast I did, so I'm curious as to your experience, but like when I put a broadhead on the end of an arrow and I draw it and I shoot it, I feel differently. Like having a broadhead on the end of an arrow than I do a filled tip. Do you feel the same way?
100%.
Isn't that weird?
Like you're like focusing more, or you just like are thinking about the outcome of what's going to happen, or what?
I don't know what it is. I'd be curious, but it's like I just feel more anxiety. Like I just feel more anxious. Like as soon as I look down the end of my arrow and I go to full draw and I have a broadhead on the end of it, it feels different. Like I would say that I feel more focused. It feels like the outcome is like more important, so I feel more focused. Yeah. But I also do feel like this induced anxiety a little bit.
That's what it is for me. It's because when I have a broadhead and I know I'm shooting a broadhead, like I want that thing to hit exactly where I'm aiming so bad. Like I want it to be my best shot. Because like you want, it's just like that confidence. You want that confidence that your broadhead is flying exactly where you're aiming. Mm-hmm. Where if it doesn't, you start to like doubt yourself or what's going on with this arrow. Maybe this broadhead's not flying straight. It's like pressure, right? It's just like if you need to shoot a good score, like you feel that more heightened pressure.
Do you think you could shoot a Vegas 300 if you shot it with broadheads? You might.
Like 20 yards, maybe. I might need some bigger bars.
Do the broadheads count as cutting lines?
Right, broadheads bigger.
Nope.
We should have gotten a guillotine at that sucker.
That's an interesting thought, though, because I feel the same thing. But what are you shooting for bow and arrows and stuff? What are you going to shoot?
So the arrows, I just started shooting day six arrows this summer. Some new arrows. So I've always shot, you know, gold tip pretty much my whole entire life. And I started shooting some day six arrows, which I have been super impressed. I think they're great arrows. I shoot the XD, so they're a little bit lighter. They're 5 mm diameter, so a little bit bigger, but that's like their lighter version compared to their HD version, which is pretty heavy in my opinion. You know, I try to keep my arrow 430 to 470 for total weight.
Do you know how many grains per inch off the top of your head those are?
I think they're 9.9.
Okay. And then do you know total arrow weight on one?
Yeah, so they're 9.9 grains per inch. My total arrow weight on this is 464.
Gotcha.
I actually cut them a half inch shorter than what I normally do to cut some more weight. But as far as like components, they have really good components. So it's like they have an insert with a collar sleeve that goes over the top, which I like. They have.
Is that 50 grain insert?
I have an aluminum. So they have different options. They have like titanium, aluminum, all titanium, all aluminum. I think it's 45.
Okay.
Is the all aluminum. I was trying to like cut as much weight as possible because they're already kind of heavy arrows. Mm-hmm. So I was going light. Really good knocks. That's the one thing I will say about the gold tip knocks are a little weak. You can definitely break those pretty easily. These are good, sturdy knocks. And then just like spine consistency. You know, I've shot all my arrows through paper. You know, there's hardly any knock tuning. Spinning them, like they all spin really good. Like I usually will get a couple arrows that, you know, are little wobblers. It seems like with these day six, you know, don't hardly get any wobblers out of a dozen. But the one thing I will say, so that's the epoxy system that they have for the insert.
Uh-huh.
So that gives you the ability, so it doesn't dry as fast. You can spin, you know, your outsert. So you keep spinning that outsert until there's no wobble. And like that's one thing that a lot of the times your wobble is from your outsert.
Yeah.
If you square your arrows, if you have everything squared away, like your outsert's gonna give you that wobble at the end of your arrow. And just being able to spin that, you know, keep spinning until you get it perfectly straight. And you get a little bit added consistency, but
yeah.
No, I've liked the arrows so far. I think they fly good.
Did Remy just buy that? Does Remy own day six?
Yeah. Yeah, Remy owns them.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you know, are they, I don't even know, are they pretty readily available? Like, does your local pro shop carry those?
No, that's the one thing I don't like.
Gotcha.
But yeah, because that's who Remy reached out to me and was asking me about like which arrows I shoot and if I wanted to shoot some day six. I'm like, yeah, I'll try them out. Like,
yeah.
I've heard decent things about them. But yeah, that's the one thing that does kind of suck. It's like, if I'm down a couple arrows, I used to be able to just like go to any store and buy, you know, some arrows and just have some backups. But I will say the one thing that is good about day six that definitely cuts on time, if you wanted, is they can build it out completely. It's like,
oh, really?
They'll cut it, they'll glue it, they'll fletch it. It's like you order it and you're getting your arrows completely done, customized to what you need. It's like, that does save you some time. I don't know why I don't do that.
What are you shooting for veins?
I hate building arrows so much.
Yeah, love it. What are you shooting for veins?
I got the Flex Fletch 360s on these.
Are you shooting them in a four fletch?
I'm shooting them in a four fletch. The reason is, so I had air razors on here before.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I saw that all the testing that James Yates did and all the data. And, you know, for what I'm looking in an arrow and what I need, what I feel is like important, like the Fletch Flex 360, I feel like fit that bill for stuff that I want in my arrow. But I want, like, I already had my sight tape made. Like, I already have, you know, my pin sighted in. So I was trying to keep, like, pretty close to the same weight. So if I did four, it's going to be, like, the same weight as my air razor fletchings that I've already, like, built a lot of my system around. Gotcha. I think it's like 1 grain different.
Have you shot those into a target? They recover okay?
They recover. I will say they recover better than the air razor by far, easily.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. No, they've, yeah, they rebound a lot better than
they live. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about when the arrow goes all the way through into the target and the veins are hitting the target?
Yeah. So, like, the air razors are kind of known for. You pull them out, like, they'll never be the same. Like, you have to refletch. That's definitely the case. I had some that did that. Yeah, they fly great though. I mean, they're definitely a good vein, super lightweight, good profile.
Yeah,
but yeah, they don't rebound. These definitely rebound better than I've heard. Like, this material, you know, just like doing like a hair dryer, some like hot heat takes out a lot of the wrinkles.
What are you shooting? You shooting Severs still? 1.5s?
Till I die.
Okay.
I don't care what anyone says about fixed blade or expandables. You're stupid if you don't shoot an expandable.
You're here, folks.
I don't want to hear anything about fixed blades being all that good. They suck. You shouldn't shoot a fixed blade. Simple as that.
Dive in a little bit deeper. Why are you thinking that way?
As an archer, forgiveness is everything. Hitting where you're aiming is the most important thing. Fixed blades go against everything. They're not very forgiving. Depending on which one you use, there's definitely some that are more forgiving than others. Mm-hmm. They're not very forgiving in one, how they fly, and two, the wounds that they leave. So that's leaving, you know, more air to happen. Versus an expandable, they fly better and they're more forgiving. Like, as far as the wound channel, if you hit an animal 1 inch or 2 inches a direction, like, you're more likely gonna find that animal versus a fixed blade. Is my opinion. And just being building the most forgiving setup and having the best luck possible, I think expandable is gonna be your best option by far.
The mechanical fixed blade debate is always, it's like always ongoing, right? But it seems like in the last year, for whatever reason, it feels like it's amped up even more so. It feels like I've taken more questions and more calls and emails from folks that are, you know, wound up about mechanicals. So it's always, that one's interesting to me. It feels like it's ever present and ongoing and will never, I've gotten to the point where I'm just like, you know, if you want to shoot a fixed blade, like, shoot a fixed blade. I don't care. Like, I killed a lot of elk with a fixed blade. I killed for years and years and years. I hunted with a fixed blade, and they were great. They were fine. I mean, I found elk. A lot of cases, I heard bulls die. I saw bulls die. You know, I thought they flew okay, which they do. But then, you know, mechanicals, same thing. I've also killed elk with mechanicals, and they've died quick, and the blood trails have been awesome. And then, you know, I've never really had anything quantifiable. A lot of it was anecdotal, right? Like, I just feel like these fly better. I feel like they're more, but I didn't ever track it, right? Be like, oh, these are more accurate, right? Or these are more forgiving when my form isn't exactly right. But, you know, when you see this study that the Yates did, and you look at it, and the group size, the average group size for mechanicals is like 3 to 3.5 inches, I think. And then your average group size for fixed blades is like 4 to 7 inches. It's like double. He basically goes through and says, yeah, the group size for, you know, the average group size for fixed blades is double what it is for mechanicals. For me, that's really hard to debate, right? Because for me, the ultimate goal is to hit the animal where I intend to hit it, and, you know, penetration kind of be damned, to not be damned, but to some extent, you know what I mean? I think for me, I would always take an arrow that hit behind the pin in the vitals. You know, even if I got less penetration, like, I feel better about that shot than I do, you know, an arrow that's less accurate. And I had a conversation with a buddy. I was texting back and forth. He was asking some questions about fixed blades versus mechanicals. I think he put a post up on social, and he was kind of just doing some fishing and asking for people's opinions. And I don't think there are that many people that are shooting a setup that is pushing enough force that they're going to put even the most robust two blade fixed head through some elk shoulder, and they're going to kill it. Right. And then, yeah. And then if they do, in my opinion, and I don't know, maybe this is controversial to say, but I would rather have my mechanical break off in an elk shoulder and have it run off than push a fixed blade, two blade head, 2 inches into the lung, one lung, and have that animal live for 2 or 3 days and then die. And then potentially not have me find it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I land. And I don't know, it might sound weird, but that's kind of where I'm at on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think too, when you think about a fixed blade, under pressure shooting it, uneven ground. I mean, the torque that you're putting on a bow when an animal comes in, like the average person who probably doesn't shoot their bow enough, like, that fixed blade's not going to fly it where you're aiming.
And then the interesting thing too, so you say that average group size of fixed blade versus mechanical, that was on a shooting machine.
Well, the,
yeah.
So then you add the human, element in there, and what is that fixed blade group actually going to do average? Like, sure, you could make one shot that, like, oh, it's perfectly in there. Sure, everyone can do that sometimes. But that average group size, is that going to grow? Obviously, a lot when you add human element to shooting that bow.
Oh, yeah. Just a little bit of torque on a fixed blade.
You're sweating. You're excited. You're jacked. You got a big bull coming in and torque it one way.
Yeah.
I mean, not to poke holes in what I've done before, but, like, I've always been back and forth shooting fixed and mechanicals. And then the last bow hunt I ever did, I switched from a mechanical to a fixed blade and hit that 207-inch buck and lost it. And obviously there's a million other factors that go into it, but I still think to this day, if I had a bigger cutting diameter, or that arrow tracked maybe a little bit better, maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe it was a fixed blade's fault for a track, but I do believe if I had a bigger cutting diameter with a mechanical, the result might be a little bit different. Obviously, a million other factors again, but if I ever bow hunt again for deer, I will never use a fixed blade ever again.
That's what I figured out when I was 12 years old. I put on a fixed blade, couldn't find.
Where were you to tell me that, Neville?
I couldn't get him to fly straight. I'm 12 years old shooting a fixed blade, couldn't get him to ever fly straight. If I shot something and it was like a little bit off, you know, 12-year-old, not the best shot on animals, like, you'd never find the animal. Even if you hit it in the liver, like, you're never finding it. So then I went to huge broadhead, expandable broadheads.
Yep.
Never lost a deer again.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. It's an ongoing debate. It's one I've almost a little bit checked out of. I'm just like, shoot what makes you happy. And if you think a two-blade fixed is the way to go, then freaking go for it. put your time in and put your time and practice into it, but, you know, run with it if that's what you're confident in. I don't care. I just think, you know, ultimately we'd probably all do better off if we quit thinking about it and we picked up a couple and just shot them and just practiced our ass off with them. You know what I mean? Like if we just bailed on the whole debate and then just put our time and effort into actually practicing with broadheads, we'd probably all be better off, I think.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Nobody's shooting enough with their broadheads.
Yeah, I'm not. Certainly not. I'm trying, but I definitely don't do. I mean, it's like I said, if I have a, you know, broadhead tipped arrow and I go to draw that thing back and I feel anything different than I do when I'm just shooting a field tip, I'm not shooting it enough, you know?
Be it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing sucks, though, they eat your targets up.
Oh, yeah.
They chomp those things down.
Yeah. Yeah, but worth it in the end. Oh, right? Yeah, to be confident.
For sure.
Tell us about this little side venture you got going on.
Rough Ridge Stove Company?
Yeah.
We're moving along good. Yeah, so we just released, it was like a couple months ago, just kind of like announced to the public about this, you know, new hunting company that my brother are starting called Rough Ridge Stove Company, which is essentially what we're making our backcountry cook systems is our sole focus. So we had this idea. I was actually still working at Gohan at the time. It was like 3 years ago, of kind of making our own cook system. And it came out of, you know, at the time we were Frankensteining our systems. I was buying my stove from this company. I was buying my pot from this company. I was buying my sport from this company and trying to like put together the best system for backcountry hunting. And from that, I realized, like, why don't we have, you know, an all-in-one system specifically made for backcountry hunting and what I want out of my cook system. So that's kind of how we got the idea. And then just spent the last 3 years, you know, refining it, you know, picking out all the best features that we like from, you know, pots, stoves, sporks, and just pretty much putting together the ultimate cook system for backcountry hunters. And pretty excited to finally be able to announce to the public. It's literally been walking around like the secret for 3 years. I mean, you guys knew, but most people didn't know what we were doing. And yeah, just happy to finally be at this spot where we actually have like prototypes. We've been using it in the field and ready to show it. I want to show the full product.
What are you trying to do over other stoves that you used in the past?
Specifically. Yeah, so to me, what it was a lot of these systems have like one feature that I liked, and you know, they're too heavy, too bulky, or they were too light and didn't have any features like no wind protection, ultra lightweight, but maybe wouldn't work, you know, in certain windy conditions or at high altitude. It seemed like there's just like a lot of mismatch of different systems that had like maybe one or two features that I liked, but never had every single feature that I wanted in a cook system as far as my pot, my spork, my stove. So it's basically just trying to like put together what I want, exactly what I want for my stove, for my pot, for my spork, and then to have it all work together. Like our pot is specifically built for our stove. To get the most efficiency out of a system, it's not just your stove. It's how your pot fits on your stove, the distance in between your stove and pot. Like there's all these different variables that if you don't look at it as one system, like that affects your performance and efficiency as a whole. So just having like everything built specifically for each other, giving us, you know, the ultimate system when it comes for efficiency, packability, weight, you know, everything. And that's kind of like what we wanted to build with our stove system. I mean, it's basically what we wanted. I want this in a stove. I want this in a pot. I want this in a spork. I want this in my fuel canister, and then going out and building that.
I also think it's pretty badass that you have a stove company that's made by hunters.
For hunters.
Because you always hear the rumors about like all these other stoves out there. Stove companies are kind of anti-hunting in a way. You know, like there's all those rumors about every single one of them out there that like they kind of support it, sell them, but in the background, they're owned by some other bigger company. you know, that are anti-hunting.
Right. Well, and the thing is, the main difference, right, the general camper demographic, what they're building their products for, those people are going out when they want to, when it's 70 degrees, when it's sunny, you know, don't have to hike too far. Like, it's perfect conditions for camping. That's how they're building the product for their demographic, which is completely different from a hunter who needs a stove system that works not only in the summer, but also works in the winter, cold temperatures at 12,000 feet when the wind's blowing 20 miles an hour. Like, they're not worried about that outlier because their demographic who's buying that, hardly any of them. So they're not building their product for that.
Yeah, that's an outlier in their sense, but for hunters, that's the standard.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you see that with, if you go on Amazon, look at these other companies, and I mean, that's what I was essentially doing when we first started. Like, I was just reading hundreds of reviews. What do people hate about their stove systems? What is it? And you go on Amazon, you look at any of the competitors, it's usually a hunting scenario. It's like a hunter saying, X, this system didn't work when I was at 12,000 feet and it was below freezing. It's because that system's not made to be there. It's not made for that scenario. And I think that's like the main thing why, like, the problem that we saw.
Were you trying to hit like like a certain weight limit, boil time? I mean, when you build this, what was the process like from building a stove from ground up?
So what we did is we got, you know, like, my brother and I, like, put a list together of your favorite features that you like and any system it may be, anything that exists, anything out there. Write down your must-haves for a stove. Write down your must-haves for a pot. Write down your must-haves for a spork. And essentially, we have this list of features that we absolutely need to have in our system. And then it's like, all right, now we need to go find a designer. We're going to give him these ideas that we have. We need him to put together. So then we had a designer, like, give us a bunch of different drawings, and it's kind of refining that. And then the hardest part is, right, like, everyone has a good idea of all these different things, but then going to find someone to make it. Mm-hmm. That's what took us 3 years. Like, the idea and the features, like, that took us, you know, a couple months to figure out exactly what we wanted. What took us the longest is building a system with everything that we want, because no one's built that. Like, no one's built what our pawn is. Yeah. So having to find a manufacturer to build something that they're not used to, is what took us the longest to get to this point. But yeah, we're just adamant on the features that we want in our system, and that's kind of how we came together. Like, that's how we built it. It was just based on the features that we wanted.
How far out are you from production?
So we have like our finalized prototypes. So some people are like a little bit confused. It's going to be a full system. So it's a pot, titanium pot. We have a titanium wind guard, a stove, a spork, and fuel canisters. So it's going to be a completely full system when you buy it. And we just got finalized all of our prototypes right now. And we're looking at probably like early 2026 is when things will be for sale for the public. Right now, we're like trying to get enough prototypes that we can hand out to guys like you, you know, to use out in the field this fall. Plus, that gives us the opportunity to like get content around it. But as far as like our social media and YouTube stuff, like, we're going to show the system before it comes out.
Yeah.
Like, right now we can't show it because we're working through like a couple patents, like making sure we have everything like secure there. But once we have that, like, we're going to show, you know, everyone what this system looks like, what it does, and essentially just educate, you know, get content around it, build up hype, and then have it available to buy in early 2026 is our plan.
Gotcha. That'll be good, man.
It's like,
been a hot minute coming, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the things that you think wouldn't take the longest to make. Take the, like, pot, the spork. Like, I thought the stove. So we started first doing the stove because we thought that, like, this will take us the longest to make, you know, the specific features, pressure regulator, all that stuff in our stove, because it's like the most complex. That was the easiest to make.
Hmm.
The pot, way harder. I have one hint about the pot. It's not round. Dude. So that's why it was the hardest to make. Is the trick about that. And then the spork, which you would thought would be the easiest thing, but
we gave it. But that's what's cool though. You're doing something different. You're right. Thinking about problems that we've all had in the field, and you're creating a solution, and you're doing it right by having all sorts of experience that hunters have had before. It's not like you're explaining before where, yeah, they just go out in 70 degrees, it's sunny, and oh yeah, we're going to make a mountain house right now, and there's no wind, and it's beautiful out, and that's why they take all these beautiful photos always with their marketing. Hunters hunt shitty freaking conditions, and it has to work. What's the worst thing when it doesn't work? Or when we were, you know, hunting a couple of years ago together when it was below zero the entire time. We're trying to melt snow. When your stove goes out in those conditions, you're completely effed. That was the only way we got water.
Yeah, done for.
And how much times did we put them on and like obviously take off and like fuel goes everywhere and it just doesn't freaking work?
Yeah.
Because we're at way too high of elevation, at way too cold temperatures. It's freaking windy and we need water.
Yeah, I would say probably like 80% of stoves don't have, it's called a pressure regulator or fuel regulator.
Mm.
Don't have those built into their stoves. Most of them don't. And that's basically affects your performance at high altitude and cold temperatures.
Yeah.
So they won't work if they don't have that.
I don't have any exact tests here because I did the test thing and then we went to New Zealand and so we actually used your stove portion in New Zealand. But that sucker boils fast. Oh, yeah. And it's not even the whole system yet.
Yeah.
Like testing it out there, like be prepared, people. Just be prepared. Neville spared no expense.
I think like a jet boil is almost like a pound, like a full system. It's like 14, 15 ounces. I mean, they don't ever weigh anything with their spork. So you got to add that in there as well, which is usually around amounts. Right now, our system is looking, this is stove, pot, wind guard, spork, under 10 ounces.
Nice.
Is what we're looking at, like 9.6 ounces is what we're... So it's going to be lightweight compared to other all-in-one system, which is super important,
obviously. Is your lid made out of titanium as well?
Yeah. It'll be titanium lid for now, we think. The lid's actually taking us some time, too.
Yeah, but...
I have a pot, but I don't have a lid.
Well, it's cool, man. It's been fun to see it kind of come along. I know you've been working on it a long time, and I'm stoked to see like where you take it in this next year. It'll be fun to hopefully get you I don't know if you plan on like hitting some events or something like in the new year, January through May. But hopefully you get a chance to like get out and get it in people's hands, because I think that's like one of those things where it seems maybe a little bit elementary, but reality is it's probably one of the most important pieces of gear that you will have, especially if you're a backpack hunter, is your ability to boil water. And, you know, either you're making drinking water for yourself or you're, you know, making a hot meal for yourself. But it'd be fun to see you get it out into people's hands and give them a chance to like fill it and play with it and, you know, actually see what you guys have come up with.
Yeah. We've, from like our Instagram and social and stuff, like a ton of people have been reaching out. Like,
yeah,
I mean, people are excited just because they haven't bought a stove system in 10 years or something. Like they've had the same one, like they've just been sitting on because they haven't had a need to buy anything different. Like this is just kind of what they've been stuck with.
Yep. Yeah. It's like a lot of things in my life. I've just, it's like, yeah, it works. Okay. But like, I haven't really, you know, put enough effort or time into something else. You know what I mean? To even see what else is out there and bought one. So yeah. Yeah. Whatever.
For sure.
Well, that's cool, man. We're stoked. We'll hopefully we'll get a chance to like take a look at one and maybe do some content with you just to see what you come up with.
Yeah, I should have. Hopefully, we should have some prototypes to hand out to you guys during a couple of weeks. Fingers crossed. Everything always takes longer, so don't hold your breath.
Yeah.
Well, right on, Brady. Do you have any other questions for Christopher Neville?
No, I just miss hanging out with the old. Yep. The old Neville.
We do miss you around the office.
I miss you guys too. I'm just in my hot house all by myself all the time.
Yeah. You're also selling merch. So before we cut you loose, you got to let people know what they can pick up.
the big hunting guy merch. We got big elk guy, big mule deer guy, big duck guy, big archery guy. We got all sorts of big guys that you can choose from. But hopefully I have a couple more designs coming this fall for that as well. So
how's it been going? Has it been pretty good?
Yeah. It's pretty easy for me.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know this, but it's print on demand. So I don't actually ship or anything. Like I just have my website and market and make designs and stuff, but it's all shipped from a different, orders, shipments, all that stuff go through a different place. So I don't have to deal with any of that. So it's pretty easy for me.
Yeah.
Not a lot of work for me, just to think of ideas. So if you got any design ideas, that's what I'm always looking for. Gotcha. Just some new design ideas.
Yeah. Big rifle guy.
I do need to do big rifle guy.
Big heavy rifle guy.
That's right.
Big 300 rum guy.
Yeah.
Just throwing them all out right now for you.
That's right. I love it, Brady.
Yeah. Well, Neville, for people that are maybe newer to the podcast, you probably don't know, but Neville is the originator of the Big Hunt Guys. So he came up with the name Big Hunt Guys. And then that's where we started with. He was the namesake. And then, you kind of took off and you've done your own merch line with different stuff. So Big Elk Guy, Big Archery Guy, whatever it is. That's kind of always been your tagline, is Big Gun.
Yeah. I just got sick of writing captions for something.
Yeah, that's how it came up, yeah.
I'll just do everything, just Big Guy. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to worry about it. Just put that out there. Made it easy to write Instagram captions. So that's kind of where it came from.
Yeah. Right on, Chris Neville. We hope you get out in the field and kill a giant buck. And then you kill a great bull. And then I'll see you in November in Arizona. We'll go down and give her a rip for 10 or 15 days or however long we feel like, right?
That's right. We may never leave.
Yeah, that's right.
Just live there.
Wait, we might. Yeah, shoot straight. Have fun. Have a good day. We appreciate you jumping on. I said, we all miss you around and consider you a good friend and always hope to stay in touch and wish nothing but the best for you guys.
Yeah, same goes to you guys.
Yeah, have a good one.
Appreciate you, boss.
Later, dudes.